has a kind of preface, prelude, prologue, pick your favorite P word, to the sermon, a brief couple paragraphs from one of the essays in W.E.B. Du Bois' classic book, The Souls of Black Folks, written in 1903. It is a peculiar sensation, this double consciousness, this sense of always looking at oneself through the eyes of others, of measuring one's soul by the tape of a world that looks on in amused contempt and pity. One ever feels his two-ness, an American, a Negro, two souls, two thoughts, two unreconciled strivings, two warring ideals in one dark body whose dogged strength alone keeps it from being torn asunder. The history of the American Negro is the history of this strife, this longing to attain a self-conscious manhood, to merge his double self into a better and truer self. In this merging, he wishes neither of the selves to be lost. He simply wishes to make it possible for a man to be both a Negro and an American without being cursed and spit upon by his fellows, without having the doors of opportunity closed roughly in his face. I have spent the years since my retirement in 2007 researching my family's history of slaveholding. I've discovered truths about my family that I'd rather not know, like the truth that one of my ancestors was so harsh a slaveholder that his enslaved people rose up and murdered him slowly. Of course, part of that research included learning as much about American slavery as I could. And that work changed me. Among other things, I've come to understand how deeply our American racism is embedded in our history of slavery. They are inseparable. And if we would redress racism, it is imperative that we also address our involvement in slavery. If we would heal our racist hearts, we must begin where the wound was made. And the wound was made in slavery. Now imagine this. You're out in the fields, cotton fields, working the cotton fields, been working from can't see and will be working until can't see. Finally, it gets to be evening. You and the other enslaved people are brought in to a shack, a shed lined up. And the overseer goes through how each person had done. Three did not meet their quota. 10 lashes apiece for each of them as punishment. Finally, you're sitting in front of the fire, just staring at the fire, and you remember the last time you saw your mother. She was kneeling in the road. Your owner had incurred some debts that he couldn't pay, so he sold you to a slave trader. Your mother is kneeling in the road, her arms outstretched, crying and shouting, "Don't take my child! Please, massa, don't take my child!" This is American slavery. Brutish, inhumane, and very profitable. How profitable was it? Well, think about this. every single economic institution created in the United States from the Revolution to the Civil War was put together on purpose to encourage and extend slavery. If you'd like to read the details of how that worked, I refer you to Edward Baptist's recent book, The Half Has Never Been Told. He's an economic historian at Cornell. The United States in 1860 owned a virtual monopoly on the world's cotton trade. We controlled 60% of the cotton trade. And cotton in the Euro-American world, and even in Asia, cotton was the oil that greased the economy of the world. We controlled 60% of it. Every time I do a talk like this, whether it's a sermon or some other public talk, I can almost count on someone coming over and saying, "Look, slavery is long over, barely remembered, so just get over it. Nobody cares." Well, I beg to differ. Here's another story. Little boy, 5 years old, and his family go to Richmond, Virginia for some kind of family event, and his parents decide he's too young to go to the event itself, so they leave him at his great aunt's house to be babysat by a cousin. While he is there, he is taken up to a back room up in the upper stories of the house, where he's introduced to Mary. Mary is a very old African-American woman bent over. The thing that catches this little boy's eye is his brilliant white cap that she wears, white cotton cap. He'd never seen anything like that. Well, the boy grows up, and he remembers Mary. For some reason, he remembered. And so he starts asking some questions and then looking for answers. He discovers her last name. Through most of his life, he only ever heard her referred to as Mary. But he discovers her last name was Jones, Mary Jones. He discovers that in 1961, Mrs. Jones died, thought to be about 100 years old, because no one knew, including her, when she was born, thought to be about 100 years old. So she was born in about 1861. And he discovers that his ancestor in 1860 had enslaved a young African-American woman who was about 20 years old. And he adds all this up, and he realizes that the chances are he met the last living person enslaved by his family. This is a true story. I am the man that little boy grew up to be. And if I met a woman who was owned by my family, slavery was not that long ago. Another thing that I can almost count on is get over your guilt trip. You're not responsible for your ancestors' sins. Well, there are a lot of variations on that one, but it's never that simple, is it? Responsibility is a complicated concept. This kind of remark is always, always said to me by a European American, never, ever by an African American. Never, ever. That says something, doesn't it? Well, it turns out that there are two concepts of responsibility. In one, we are responsible for things done, actions taken, or as the case may be, not taken. We're responsible to obey the law, or put with for language, responsible for obeying the law, meeting our commitments, reconciling with people we wrong. And in this sense, of course I'm not responsible for the sins of my ancestors. Nobody's responsible for another person's actions. But there's another concept. We're being responsible to. We are responsible to one another. We are responsible to the culture we live in. And we are responsible to hand on to our descendants a better world than was given to us. So, I am responsible to make this world a better place than I found it. And I am responsible to raise my children to be humane, loving, and generous adults. And I am responsible to support and participate in organizations and to keep them healthy, especially organizations that work for racial reconciliation. In this sense, we are all responsible to the future, to help create and pass on a reality that is less hate-filled and violent than the one we received. For the truth is that this world we live in, every one of us has inherited its racism and its violence. Doesn't matter when your ancestors came over here or how. Doesn't even matter whether you happen to be the immigrant yourself. We live in a nation that is rife with racism. And that racism is the direct descendant of American slavery. Doubt that? Well, think about that passage from the Du Bois book that I read a few moments ago, that description of the two worlds he had to live in 1903. That divided consciousness had its roots in a hatred that was bred in the muck, mire, and blood of slavery. White America's contempt did not spring willy-nilly out of nowhere as the Civil War merged into Reconstruction and Jim Crow. But what of 2019? Anything essential change since 1903? Well, does anyone here seriously think that ours is a, quote, post-racial society? Does anyone really think that the GOP treatment given to President Obama had nothing at all to do with his being black? Does anyone think that the rash of police violence against African Americans is merely an accident of statistics and has nothing to do with racism? Does anyone really think that the rash of visible rash of racial hatred and violence has nothing to do with Trump's reckless rhetoric? Or think about the racial stereotype of the dangerous, large, strong, lascivious, angry black man. That stereotype has fed every lynching of every African American ever killed by any mob, up to and including the 20th and probably the 21st century. We Euro-Americans created it, though its actual history is a little hard to trace, but I know for sure it goes way back into slavery. It was already full-blown in 1838, and you can find it in Fanny Kimball's diary. And it was certainly alive and well in the 1950s and 60s and was responsible for the murder of the leaders of the Black Panther Party. And I say it is alive and well in 2019. You can find it in the police violence against people of color and Trump's rhetoric and failure to act and failure to condemn that very violence. Think about this. A young Euro-American can walk around in public carrying an assault rifle and no one even thinks to call the police. Doesn't occur to a soul. But a young African-American boy playing with a toy gun is accosted, shot, and killed by Euro-American police. Which brings us to Black Lives Mattering. Do Black Lives matter? Do Black lives matter as much as white lives matter? There was a meme going around a couple of years ago when Black Lives Matter first got organized. Nothing is more indicative of white supremacy than the fact that the phrase Black Lives Matter is controversial. Now, I don't know whether this congregation has embraced the Black Lives Matter movement or not. I just don't know. And I don't know how anyone here may feel about it. But I do know that I've heard Unitarian Universalists say everything from right on to BLM is racist. And I know some Unitarian Universalists seem to think it should be replaced by all lives matter because, of course, all lives do matter. Well, all lives matter is fine as an ideal, as something to strive for, to work toward, to embrace as a guide to move us into the future. But as a description of the real world, it is simply false. All lives do not matter in this country because far too often the lives the lives of people of color do not matter to far too many Euro-Americans. The truth is that the overwhelming majority of cases of police violence are against African-Americans and people of color. And this has been true in America ever since there has been an America. Most of my African-American friends point out that all lives matter is nothing more nor less than a way of hiding from the truth while trying to appear as an ally. And by the way, speaking of being an ally, it is not for European Americans to say of themselves that they're an ally. If you say that of yourself, you're not. It is for people of color to bestow upon you, not for you to claim. Until we embrace fully, and I do mean fully, down as deep in your heart as you can go, fully, the truth that African American lives are in constant peril through police violence, through educational violence, through governmental violence, through cultural violence, and through all sorts of other forms of violence, all lives will not matter in America. Until we recognize the rage that burns in the souls of Americans of color and accept our responsibility and accountability for it, all lives will not matter. Until we open our hearts and listen to our African American and other people of color neighbors. And not just with these things. Any fool can listen with these, but with these, with our hearts, with our souls. That's what I mean. Until we put aside that privileged place and open our hearts to people of color, all lives will not matter. And that is why it is so important to say over and over and over without ceasing, Black Lives Matter. I want to close with a poem I wrote several years ago that was inspired by some of the research and writing that I've done. The sky opened. Fire fell in torrents and burned everything. The big house, the shacks, everything shriveled like forbidden graven images. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. It was not us, they will say. It was long ago. It was someone else. And who shall say, thy people shall be my people, and those who are unloved shall be beloved? Who indeed? Who shall say it, if not us?